a three-week series on the ancient Buddhist school known as the Yogacara. So is this a word that is, I'm assuming this word is fairly new to many people. So tonight I will give an overview of the sort of major teachings and viewpoint of this school that arose in the late Mahayana period in India, middle Mahayana period in India, reached a flowering between, say, the 2nd and 7th centuries. So tonight, an overview of this school and its teachings, and then next time, considering one of its major old scriptural sources, which is a tongue twister called the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra. And the final class will be on yet another, not a scriptural source, but like a treatise on the Yogacara called Vasubandhu's 30 Verses. So this is a big topic, and it's not so much time to really cover such a big topic, but I'm going to do my best to give an introduction. My purpose in this class is not to be academic, although it may appear a little bit that way at times. It's sort of unavoidable that it would come out that way, since I have, in preparation for the class, been studying a number of academic sources, so I can't ignore those, and some of them are very, very helpful in terms of describing what this is for Western ears. Because when it's described in the original presentation, it assumes a rather vast knowledge of Buddhism, and various antecedents and so forth. So I heard a story on the radio last week. I think it was last week, and it was a story that's sort of apropos of nothing, but you'll see why it relates. Anyway, the story was the viewpoint of an economist, and he was talking with some disgust about how politicians use economics to basically, they selectively use economics to support their positions and their accomplishments and so forth. They just pick and choose what they want to do. And his analogy was that politicians use economics like a drunk uses a lamppost for support, but not for illumination. So I think that's, for me, that's relevant to what my intent is here, is to offer something that is both of support and illumination for your practice. These teachings, I think, are quite relevant to your practice. And since I've been studying them and writing about them and reading about them, I have noticed myself that there's a kind of change has come over my sitting as a result of considering these practices. I think we can hopefully you will find these teachings and this presentation of some illumination in that way, some kind of commentary on what just sitting, our practice, really is. So in one traditional presentation, which we've heard in this hall before, and this set of aphorisms is attributed to Bodhidharma, a description of what Zen practice is a separate transmission outside of the scriptures, not dependent on words and letters, pointing directly to the human heart or the human mind, seeing Buddha nature and becoming Buddha. So this is a set of four aphorisms pointing out to us what the point of Zen practice is, I guess. And the way it starts, I think, would tend to the way it starts a separate transmission outside of the scriptures, not dependent on words and letters, would tend to point us in the direction of not considering Buddhism from an academic standpoint, not thinking that an understanding of the Buddha's awakening is and our own awakening and the awakening of our fellow Sangha members, which we care deeply for as well, that awakening is not dependent on some intellectual grasp of what these teachings are. And I think, you know, I endorse that view. I think many of us are, certainly myself, for many years was not particularly interested in the deeper sort of understanding or ferreting out of where all these ideas in Zen come from, or where this practice comes from. And then I do think that it may be sufficient for most people to read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, about 6 or 10 or 15 times, and that may be sufficient for many years of practice. But one of the kind of joys of going a little deeper into study is what is revealed is the sources that you can see that Suzuki Roshi is drawing on in his teaching, and you begin to be able to clearly see where some of this is coming from and how deep the roots are in this tradition called Mahayana Buddhism. And that's kind of it's kind of a exciting aspect of study, that you see these teachings coming through. And the teaching of Mahayana Buddhism is incredibly rich, because the Mahayana arose. The Mahayana is not a fundamentalist movement, right? The Mahayana arose because it arose on the basis of continuing to discuss, continuing to clarify, continuing to debate the early teachings, and then to extend those teachings, to continue to draw out meaning from those teachings. So the Mahayana movement was, you know, very well. It was, you know, it was willing to go beyond what the original teachings were. And one of the things that distinguished the Mahayana was that it was willing to accept teachings called the perfection of wisdom that arose later. That arose, they were presented as scriptural teachings, but they clearly arose later than the life of the historical Buddha. So the Mahayana was willing to accept and incorporate, and then even extend itself beyond those teachings. And actually, that's what this tongue twister Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra purports to do. It purports to look at the older teachings and the perfection of wisdom teachings, and it's kind of an interesting sutra because it's in the form of the Buddha's in the sutra, and this definitely is not a lifetime of the Buddha sutra. It's probably about the second century of the Common Era, and the formula for it is that they keep asking, "What Buddha? What were you thinking when you taught that? What were you thinking when you taught this other thing?" So we'll get into that. One of the things I've recognized in teaching classes before is that there is a fear of Buddhist words present in the Sangha. So if I say a word like Samdhi Nirmochana, there can be a blanking out that can happen in the audience. So one of the things I thought we could do is, like, for instance, on a word like that, Samdhi, we could say it together. Samdhi, Nirmo, Chana. Samdhi Nirmo Chana. Samdhi Nirmo Chana. Yeah, near is that's okay. And next week I'll talk about what that word means. We might encounter some other terms as we go through, and maybe if we say them together, then some of this fear of Sanskrit will be pacified. And of course, we're all about pacifying fears, and we don't want to bring up any new ones when we're teaching. So we know, or at least scholars tell us, that in the era or the centuries after the life of the Buddha, that there arose 18, this is the conventional number, 18 different schools of Buddhism. And some of them were philosophical schools, some of them were practice schools, some of them were both. And today we don't even know. Somehow scholars know that there were 18, but we don't even know the names of all these different schools. But somehow the number 18 keeps coming up as the number that was there. And we know the names of a few of them. But as time went on, some schools got more adherents and some schools did not, and so they faded away. And when we come to the beginning of the Common Era and into up to like the 5th and 6th century, then basically in the Mahayana, two schools of prominence. And one is the Yogacara that we're going to talk about tonight. Yogacara means yoga practice, simply yoga practice. And get more into the definition of what that means, because that's just one way of describing it. And the Yogacara is known for these teachings that are called mind only. And so we will try to explicate what that means, what mind only means. And then the other school that that sort of survived the debates and the development is called the Madhyamaka. Want to say that? Madhyamaka. Madhyamaka. And that school is associated with a fellow named Nagarjuna. Many people have heard of Nagarjuna. And that's translated as the Middle Way School. The Yogacara was really interested in meditation. Really main focus. Very interested in meditation. Really put meditation on a high pedestal, so you can see why Yogacara would be and Zen would be, you know, going down the road together. The Middle Way School, the Madhyamaka, is interested in the teachings on emptiness, and Nagarjuna, the teacher Nagarjuna in the second century, really brings out those. And explicates the Buddha's teachings on emptiness. The interesting thing about Yogacara and why it's so relevant to Zen practice is that it really reached. Of course, it's in India, right? And this is at a time in the early part of the Common Era when Chinese people are going to India. Indians are going to China, and there's a big cultural and intellectual exchange. I don't know how big, but there's some. There's some intellectual exchange, and a big part of that intellectual exchange is Buddhism. Buddhism there's Chinese pilgrims coming to India and learning about Buddhism. There's Indian pilgrims going to China and bringing sutras and scriptures and philosophical treatises and learning the language in China and translating their sutras into Chinese. Same thing, Chinese people are coming to India learning Sanskrit taking, you know, lots of sutras and philosophical discourses back to China. Major figure in that we've talked about before. Xuanzang, he was this famous Chinese pilgrim who spent 18 years traveling from China through Central Asia down into India, studying at Indian universities, learning Sanskrit, learning the academic language of Buddhism, and then collected a whole bunch of stuff and it takes it back to India. To China, and the date of his journey was the early 7th century. He was born in, I think, like 602. So this is, Yogacara is all the rage, okay, at that time. 7th century. He's born in 602. So he goes, and of course, you do a journey like that, you have to go as a fairly young man or you'd never survive it, right? So he goes in his 20s on this journey. The Yogacara is very active at this time. This is almost the main flowering. And it's right at the beginning of the Tang Dynasty, which is the main flowering time of Zen. So Yogacara teachings end up just being really, really influential because they're being brought back right at the time and of the development of the Zen school. I haven't read much about the term Yogacara itself, it means yoga practice. So I assume that everybody here knows what yoga is, and I assume that when they're naming a school Yogacara, they're basically naming it for the people that are naming it are interested in the practice of yoga, and the practice of yoga is to turn the attention inward and not outward. So is to turn our the attention in to inner experience, and to begin to look, you know, as Dogen says, to turn the light back to illuminate what this consciousness is up to, what consciousness is up to. And so people generally who are interested in knowing how we know, interested in studying how we know what we know, and what we know is valid knowledge, people like that, sorry for this word, but today we call them epistemologists, people who are interested in knowledge, in how we know what we know. And so the Yogacarans are, there have been many philosophical systems throughout the ages that are interested in this question of how we know what we know. And the Yogacarans are, above all else, concerned with these questions. And as I think you know, because I don't know what you know, but all Buddhist schools have an epistemological foundation. And that is that all Buddhist schools understand that and look at the five senses plus mind as the basis. So Buddhism many philosophical traditions throughout history, you know, start with the five senses as sort of the base thing. That, of course, well, the five senses those are our windows on the world. That's how we know what we know. Buddhism adds the sense of mind. Now, interestingly enough, it does not identify and never identifies a mind with brain. Okay, mind is more of a mind sense. It's not like located somewhere. So that's a little different than, for instance, contemporary understandings, which point to, I mean, there's a lot of contemporary understanding and probably well-founded contemporary understanding that look at the function of the brain and what it's up to. And there's many interesting research and so forth that's being done on the function of the brain and in perception, but of course they weren't doing that back when the Yogacara was being developed. So they were simply looking at the six senses, five physical senses plus mind, and then they describe, the Buddhist epistemology describes six senses, six sense fields, the objects of the senses, and six sense consciousnesses. Six sense consciousness. So this should be familiar to all of you because, why? Because when we chant the Heart Sutra, we mention this whole list of, and we say that, of course, that the senses nor their fields nor their consciousness can be found in emptiness. And that's, but how central, and, you know, we've been studying in the morning, we've been studying the harmony of difference and equality, and how central the senses are there, eye and sight, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes, thus in all things, the leaves spread from the root. So, this is very common sense epistemology. It's so obvious, right? The senses are how we know. So there is an early teaching. There is an early teaching called the Dhammapada. Many people may be familiar with the Dhammapada, and the first stanza, the first the opening stanzas, the opening, I don't know if it's called a chapter, but anyway, the opening verse, I think that's what it's called, the opening verse, because the Dhammapada is in verse. This is the very early teaching of the Buddha. The very early teaching of the Buddha, the first stanza. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So early on, very from the inception of at least the written scriptures, the mind sense, mind consciousness, technical term, mano vijnana. Let's say that one. Mano vijnana. Vijnana. It's Espanol vijnana. Right? It's that tilde over the N. So mind and vijnana, consciousness. Mind consciousness. So that's the basic sense of mind in both the list of the five, the six senses, and the list of the five skandhas, mind consciousness. So very important, and so the Yogacarans. That's the main. If they pick out one of the, you have the six senses, the six sense fields, the six sense consciousness, and together those are called the dhatus. So you've heard the dharma dhatu. Probably everybody's heard of dharma dhatu. That means, in that sense, it means realm. But when it refers to the senses, it means elements. So if those 18 are the periodic table of experience, you could say those 18 are the periodic table of experience. Mind consciousness is like, I don't know, gold or something. So you could say that mind consciousness. Or you could say that all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. That's the root position of the Yogacara. And so it goes back to, you know, the very beginning. And it captures this idea that nothing appears except what is previously conceived in human perception. Nothing appears except what is previously conceived in the mind. So conceived or perceived, yeah. That all experience is led by mind. Last week I passed. I don't know how many people read the New Yorker article. Pretty good. Sort of. So this is one of the points that he brings out in that this fellow we there, This was a wonderful coincidence for me to try to take on this topic and then have, at the beginning of April, this article on the work of a philosopher, German philosopher named Thomas Metzinger, came out the beginning of April in the New Yorker, and his work and understanding is very, very simpatico with the Yogacara understanding. And, you know, basically his viewpoint is that nothing appears to us until we make a mental model of it first. We first make a mental model of the world, and then once we make that mental model, the mental model appears. So here's a quote from that article. He says, reality, this is Metzinger. I think this is Metzinger himself. Reality, as we experience it, is a mental stage set, a representation of the world, rather than the world itself. It isn't just that we live inside a model of the external world. We also live inside models of our own bodies, our own minds, our own selves. So this is, and he uses I think it's the author of the article who makes this analogy in the article, which I found a fairly compelling analogy, which is to a simulator, like a cockpit where a pilot would be learning to fly an airplane. And so he compares this understanding of that we're basically creating a model of experience. He compares it to sitting in a simulator where we do not, the only way that we know what's outside the simulator is by looking at the instruments. There's, you know, for instance, compare it to, like, say, flying at night, okay? A pilot has to learn in a simulator how to fly based just on the instruments, because he can't see the ground, or she can't see, you know, other planes, maybe they can't see the stars, they have to fly through clouds and all this kind of thing. So they have to learn to fly in a simulator, and the only way they know what's going on is by the instruments. And the analogy is, the only way we know what's going on is through these sense instruments. And we are nothing but, this is the crux of it, we are nothing but the instruments. There is no self. There is no Karen. There's no Alan. There's no Larry. In addition to the sum of the instruments. So this is the key, you know, point, and I know we could get some good arguments going about whether this is true, and I will try to address some of those arguments, because of course that's to say that is to invite considerable debate, and that's as it should be. Another name for the Yogacara school, and this is actually one of the interesting and potentially frustrating things about Buddhist studies, is, you know, the people that created these systems, they weren't necessarily trying to be totally rigorous and consistent and always use the same word, and anyway, they didn't like peer review each other's sutras or treatises and so forth. This was not the way it was happening. So one of the difficulties of Buddhist studies is you get a variety of words that more or less mean the same thing or mean much the same thing, but may have a little bit of different nuance. So another name, there's like several other names for the Yogacara school. One is called Vijñāvāda, which means sort of like consciousness, the way of consciousness, something like that. But this one is the most descriptive, I think. This one's a real tongue twister, sorry. This one's called Vijñaptimātrata. Vijñaptimātrata. Yeah, you're not going to try to say that one. Okay, so it translates and means mere representation or mere designation. Mere only, like mere, M-E-R-E. Mere representation, mere designation. It captures this sense that our understanding is of the world is understood through the screen or filter of consciousness, and that what consciousness encounters is only its projections, and it does not reach things themselves. Now, this may be seem like quite a fine point, and you might, I can well imagine that you might say, well, so what? And I have been studying this stuff now for ever since I came up with the idea of having this class, basically, which was right after I came back from an intensive retreat. So it's become very rich for me, but I can understand upon first encountering it, it's like, you know, not so accessible. So we have to live with that. But let me just repeat. These are my words.
Can I ask that another question?
Yes, you can. Mm-hmm.
What do we do with this?
Yes.
So that I have a way of putting something to it so I can hold on to it.
Yeah.
That's in the series phenomenon.
We don't get
that
yet.
You actually use this teaching in your sitting. You can actually use this teaching in your sitting. And I have found that if you consider this teaching in your sitting, and you seriously consider that everything you're thinking when you're sitting, or everything that you may think you're perceiving, if you consider nothing is coming from outside. Nothing is coming from outside. That everything is, that you're responsible for everything you hear, everything you feel, and everything you think, and taste, touch, etc. So to consider that, your process of consciousness is the thing that you are most interested in turning back the light toward, and considering that you are this, but there is no agent, okay? So there is no agent, but there's just these impressions, and they're all coming from you. They're not coming from the outside. And this turns around our life, actually. This to live in that kind of understanding is something that really turns around our life in a quite a profound way. So I'm going to bring Suzuki Roshi to my rescue here in terms of bringing this down to a very wonderful analogy that he brings up in Not Always So. And it's a collection of lectures by Suzuki Roshi. And this lecture is called Life is Like a Movie. And so here are the crux of his lines on this question. I think it is good to be excited by seeing a movie. To some extent, you can enjoy the movie because you know that it is a movie. Even though you have no idea of the screen, Still, your interest is based on an understanding that this is a movie with a screen and there is a projector or something artificial, so you can enjoy it. This is how we enjoy our life. If you have no idea of the screen or the projector, perhaps you cannot see it as a movie. In other words, perhaps you're going to take your life too seriously. You're not going to see. You're going to take your life really seriously. You're going to think that this, that your life is happening to you. And you're going to have problems. You're going to suffer. So then it goes on. Zazen practice is necessary to know the kind of screen you have and enjoy your life as you enjoy movies in the theater. You are not afraid of the screen. You do not have any particular feeling for the screen, which is just a white screen. So you are not afraid of your life at all. You enjoy something you are afraid of. You enjoy something that makes you angry or makes you cry. You enjoy the crying and the anger too. So this is a wonderful, liberative take on representation only, on mere designation, is that he's really taking that teaching. I mean, that's pure Yogacara teaching, and he is taking that teaching and turning it in a way that it really encourages us not to take ourselves so seriously, to also to take ourselves very seriously at the same time, but not self, but our experience. To understand that experience is us, that this movie is our life, and I don't know. You just have to appreciate it as an analogy rather than me explain it.
Can I say something?
Sure.
When I first started chanting and practice, I thought to myself, "Well, this doesn't make sense. Well, how is this going to help me? And for me, how is this going to help me understand this prison life that I was living? I mean, let's be practical here. How is it going to have anything to do with
just push?
How is it going to have anything to do with me living with a bunch of convicts in a prison yard?" And so that was my first question. And then as I said, well, let me give it a try. So I practiced, I chanted, practiced, I chanted. And what I found in doing so was that everything that I had brought with my life, the whole history, the pain, the suffering, the memories, the current problems of being incarcerated, all of these things started going away. And not that they literally disappeared, but my perception and my feelings was such that those things that I was living under, that I was experiencing, it became transformed and it wasn't what it was before. And so it is in my life as I continue in the practice, that whatever things that are going on internally or externally, they don't have the same effect. They don't have the same weight.
This is the life of a person that practices, I would contend. Not the same weight. Maybe still heavy situations, but not the same weight. So I don't want to rush, you know, you through this or, my hope was to, I think in this first session, put some of these radical ideas on the table, See if you're, you know, how compelling you find them. So that's what I'm doing, and I have some more things that I could say, but I'm also willing, and, you know, we have about, you know, 15 minutes or so. I'm willing to entertain questions at this, more questions at this point, if that's what, you know, what you'd like to do. Yes, Peter.
I don't recognize this as a question so much as, I'll frame it as a question. Doesn't this put extra emphasis on language and imagination? I just feel suddenly responsible. I have to choose my language, and I choose to use my imagination, the two of which are both very much going to affect how everything occurs to me.
Well, I have this quote, I think that will speak to your question. Karen and I were traveling in Death Valley last month, and at one point she was reading me a description from the book, that like a guidebook to Death Valley. And I heard this description, and I thought, this is perfect for my class that's coming up. And it goes like this. The area, Death Valley, contains a wealth of geological phenomena, large sand dunes, sculpted rocks, isolated valleys, and volcanic craters. The canyon and mountain walls change color with the shifting sunlight. Right? You've seen some rocks that change color? Are the rocks changing color? Are the rocks changing color? No. The rocks are not changing color. There is actually no color in the rocks. The color is in the amount of light that's available to your eyes with your rods and cones in your pupil and your iris. That's all that's changing. All that's happening. There's, you know, a sea of light radiation out there, and it's bouncing off of things, and it's hitting your eye. But language, listen to the language. This is how we fool ourselves over and over and over again. You made me mad. You hurt me. You know, you did me wrong. Right? We put it out there. We think rocks are changing color. People are making us mad. People are hurting us. And we need to turn our language around. And this is what our teachers are working with us on all the time. Turn your language around. I feel hurt. I feel angry. I see some rocks. They look red right now. Do you think they look red right now? My eyes are making them look red right now, and the available light is making them look red right now. But we fool ourselves all the time, and this is we give appearances power over us. We give appearances and objective things that we project out into the environment, and then we think we can grasp them and know them and decide whether they're beneficial to us or they're pleasant or unpleasant or neutral and so forth. And then we react to our own projections. So this is to try to bring it into current, like, because this is, you know, this is a psychological teaching. It's not just a philosophical teaching. It's a psychological teaching as well. It's about our capacity, our well-developed capacity for projection. You know, this prison is a horrible place. This prison is an okay place. We have an opportunity to look at things differently depending on our projections. Yes, Peter.
And I just wanted to add that while I was speaking of words, I was also suggesting that in every single different language, there may be a different understanding based on if we're talking to ourselves in English or in Chinese or in Sanskrit.
Well, here's what Metzinger says. This is a pretty good quote. And this, you know, again, he's using things from the standpoint of a kind of a neuropsychologist. So he's not a Buddhist, although he's apparently twice a day meditator, so pretty good. He's using the language of neuroscience. So he's speaking about brains. The conscious brain is a biological machine, a reality engine that purports to tell us what exists and what doesn't. It's unsettling to discover that there are no colors out there in front of your eyes. The apricot pink of the setting sun is not a property of the evening sky. It is a property of the internal model of the evening sky, a model created in your brain. The evening sky is colorless. The world is not inhabited by colored objects at all. It is just as your physics teacher in high school told you. Out there in front of your eyes, there is just an ocean of electromagnetic radiation, a wild, raging mixture of different wavelengths. Most of them are invisible to you and can never become part of your everyday model of reality. What is really happening is that the visual system in your brain is drilling a tunnel through this inconceivably rich physical environment, and in the process, painting the tunnel in various shades of color, phenomenal color, appearance, for your conscious eyes only.
That's a great quote.
Yeah. Yeah, Brittany.
So you were saying that the six senses are like flying by the instrumentation only?
Right.
So would that mean that meditation is meditating by the seat of your pants?
Yeah, I like that.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're basically, everything that's coming in, you're just picking up, whether it's subconscious or not, but it's essentially like flying blind by the seat of your pants.
It's like looking out through a window that you can't see. You can't see a window. All there is, you know, again, the other, you know, all there is the looking. All there is perception. And it's not extrapolating. I mean, at least in meditation. I mean, this is a teaching for meditators. It's not a teaching for, you know, it's not a teaching for like walking around in your house or, you know, walking around here or driving home. It's not a teaching for that. In those kinds of settings, please consider that there are objects separate from you and that you can run into them. You know, that you should have the conventional understanding that you have to brake for the car in front of you. You know, please have that. But in meditation, we can drop that. We can drop the idea that there are there's a projector, and that we don't even go that far. We just think that objects are real. We think that sounds are real. We think that visuals are real. We think that our thoughts are real, and take them as graspable. And so, in meditation, we're invited to drop the idea that there's anything separate that we could grasp. So there was something. Oh, thank you. What he said or what I said? Okay. Okay.
Yes, Jim, this is really fascinating subject. I always like when there's something that complicated that like this, I always try to look for a counter argument to disprove it.
Mm-hmm.
That always helps me get a hold of it. And I'm thinking of a newborn child who's just come out of the womb. There is no mind consciousness there. There's I'm just hypothesizing this now, because they've had no sense experience except for the dark of the womb. And their physiological body calls, because they've never breathed air before.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, and they cry. And then they're put on their mother's breast and they suckle. And those are just instinctual, pre-programmed physical responses, not a consciousness. But so they have nothing in the brain. They have no mind image in the brain. But then you see, as the child begins to mature, very often you can tell very early on that a child has a personality. They like this. They look at human faces. And then as they begin to learn words, they're putting words on and beginning to develop that mind consciousness. So it seems to me that that's a good way to think about how we developed our mind consciousness. So if I want to go back without words, it's
yeah.
The mind of a child, a newborn.
Yeah, well, you know, there's the possibility. I mean, we have the image of the original face, for instance, in Zen.
No mind consciousness.
But according to what Metzger's, he's actually, you know, he's hooked up with all these neuroscientists and so forth, and because he's sort of doing philosophy on the back of neuroscience, and he says his understanding and the way he presents it is that really from the moment of birth, and even he says even before, the baby is taking pictures moment after moment of what's happening and building up the self model, you know, as quickly as it can. And it has to survive. If it can't build up the self model, it can't survive. So this is, you know, we're stuck with this kind of process that we are building. You know, we're building a self from the very beginning, you know, when we come along in later life to the possibility of meditational awareness, meditation is inviting us to question the self model and question the images that and the relationship to it and to others that we have built up based on the subject-object duality, separating the baby. You know, it appears when we see the baby that the baby has no sense of separation, you know, and it may be so that it's a very, even if there is one, it's very weak. It's a very weak sense of separation. But as you point out, it consistently, if the person is healthy, it will consistently grow stronger. The subject-object differentiation will consistently and quickly grow stronger, so that the person can live in the world of, you know, duality, of separate subjects and objects. Yeah, Barry, probably have to close up here pretty soon.
Have you read a book called Why Buddhism is True?
No.
Yeah, I didn't read it for a while because the name was so obnoxious. But
I thought it was, yeah.
Yes, I finally read it. It's actually a pretty fascinating book, and it's basically an evolutionary psychologist who, you know, basically, you know, came up to the same conclusion that Buddha did about what is wrong, but he couldn't figure out how to fix it. And so that's why I kind of turned to Buddhism. But the whole book is basically kind of presenting Buddhist ideas from the standpoint of neuropsychology and evolutionary psychology. And one thing he was saying, and it kind of what you're saying made me think about it, was that there's a lot of evidence that we think we're making decisions, but it's really kind of subconscious parts of our brains that make the decision, and then we're just informed about it afterwards, and we think, like, oh, I made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it, and thoughts are just a way of informing us on what decision was made by our brain kind of already. And it's like, and so we think we're the CEO kind of controlling things, but really we're just like, we're along for the ride. And it's I'm not really explaining that well, but it's a really fascinating book.
Well, what you just described is really the teaching of the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be what we, if anybody comes back next week, that's what we will talk about. Maybe I should read that passage or something, because this is a really the teaching of the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra, that basically there is an aspect of mind that looks another aspect of mind called the Alaya Vijnana, and takes that as a self, when in fact that is merely a storehouse of consciousness. So that's the teaching of the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra, and that's what I was proposing to talk about next week. One other thing I wanted to say, or I wrote down here, I had wanted to say a few more things, but maybe I'll bring those into the beginning of next week, that I wanted to sort of, and I can kind of keep, bringing forth this perspective of the Yogacara, which, you know, is a little bit hard to accept, but I really would like to invite you to, as I have in the last weeks, is to bring this teaching into your meditation during the week, and this is basically, you know, Dogen's teaching. I mean, of just turn the light around, but understanding that all there is this light, you know, all there is perception, and to just, you know, bring that into your thinking, your sort of, not your thinking, but your seat, bring that to your seat in your meditation, that your senses are just windows. Your senses are just windows on the world, and you're looking out through these windows, and really, turn the light around and like, really know I'm looking out through the windows of my senses. Just keep that in mind. I'm looking out through the windows of my senses. You know, it's just, and that's all there is. And I found that if you kind of keep that a little bit uppermost in your approach to sitting, that it has kind of a wonderful effect. Or anyway, it changes your sitting. It changes your sitting to remember that these thoughts, you're generating those thoughts. Something's they're coming from you. They're not coming from outside. And it, you know, you will go back to your usual planning, your usual, you know, things like that. And then just, you know, as we always instruct, just when you notice that you go into your planning mode, then just come back to this sense of this generative sense of a sense operation going on. There's this cockpit going on. You're in this cockpit. So just keep remembering, I'm in the cockpit, and there's all this sense stuff going on. Yeah, that's what's happening. Yeah. Okay.
Because as you're talking, I also, the words like co-arising, the interdependence of all beings, that somehow I guess I think, okay, I'm watching my projections, I'm noticing my thoughts, this is my mind consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It's more my mind consciousness, but mind is different than mind consciousness, because in that practice of noticing and watching and owning, this is my projection, and working with that, then something else drops out, or that drops out, and then there's some bigger process that's allowed to happen.
Well, of course.
Is that the difference? Is that more like the emptiness school compared to?
Well,
yes,
you were kind of bringing up the emptiness school.
Okay.
Yeah, when you talked about interdependence and so forth. But of course, we do. I mean, the main thing is, we don't do, you know, as you know, we don't do the practice just for ourselves. We may do a practice that looks very interior, but we do that practice for the benefit of everyone. And we do that for the benefit of all beings. That's certainly the, because, you know, the psychological presentation is own your projections. Own your projections. And if you're a good owner of your projections, you will help the world greatly, because you won't be causing nearly as much trouble as you have so far. So you know, to be a good owner, a good steward of your projections is you know, to really be of great, will be in itself of great benefit to everyone you know, everyone who lives with you and speaks with you and so forth, as Dogen says in the something, self-receiving and employing samadhi. So, and we do this for the benefit of all, and doing this very, you know, being yoga charans, being yoga practice people, turning the light around and looking, to illuminate the self, turning the right light around to illuminate the self. This is really so beneficial, so beneficial.
I have a 5 seconds.
How
confident are you that it's yoga chara and not yoga kara?
It has a little squiggle on the back. It's not with a CH, first of all. It's never spelled that way. And it has the little squiggle at the C. So you tell me that if that squiggle is supposed to be pronounced ch.
I don't know.
Somebody research this. But I think Yogacara is the way I've always heard it from my teachers. So I will go on that. 5 seconds. Yeah, no, that's fine. I had it spelled CH in there just so people would know how to pronounce it. Let's end with our closing chant.